for antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton, and this is Anti-War Radio.
Freedom is a road seldom traveled by the multitude.
Public enemy number one.
Sorry, guys, I'm a broken record on this, but it's been, well, a couple of weeks anyway since I went off in this form, so here it goes. Don't join the military. Young kids out there, don't join the military. Don't believe what they say in the commercials. Strong, an army strong. It's a little vague, isn't it? You notice on all those commercials, it's never Iraq outside. Yeah, I joined the army. They let me play with remote control planes all day. Bullshit. Join the army, you go play the IED lottery in an aluminum Humvee in Iraq. Lose your life for nothing. Oh yeah, join the National Guard. Just, you know, 1 weekend a month, 2 weeks a year. It's great. You get in shape, get a little discipline, learn how to kill a man in case you ever really need to. Wrong. You're going to Iraq to play the IED lottery in an aluminum Humvee. You know, they could give you Ford Rangers and at least the doors would have some iron in them. But no, they're going to send you out there in an aluminum Humvee to play the IED lottery. Maybe today's the day I get blown apart by an enemy I can't even see. Don't join the military. They don't care about you. I got an idea. How about I prove it? How about I prove that the military doesn't give the first... Well, I was going to say a bad word. Try not to do that. Here's proof the military doesn't care about the soldiers. Here's proof that the guys with all the shiny medals on their chest don't care if all you privates and specialists and so forth fall down dead. Here's proof. Top general, not a top general, the top general, underestimates Iraq war fatalities in Memorial Day media appearance by Michael Rosten, The Raw Story. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff dramatically underestimated the number of deaths of U.S. armed service members in the Iraq war. The gaffe came as General Peter Pace, no, a gaffe is when you accidentally say something true and reveal what a criminal you are. This is where he gets it wrong, accidentally, to reveal what a criminal he is. So that's not quite a gaffe. I don't know what you call that instead. Close enough. The gaffe came as General Peter Pace discussed on CBS News Monday morning, on CBS News Monday morning to discuss Memorial Day. Quote, "When you take a look at the life of a nation and all that's required to keep us free, we had more than 3,000 Americans murdered on September 11th. Oh yeah, that kept me free, huh? All those people dying? The price, we think the price is worth it? Something along those lines, Mr. Pace? Is that it? The number who have died, sacrificed themselves since that time, is approaching that number, General Pace told CBS Early Show's Harry Smith, and we should pay great respect and thanks to them for allowing us to live free. Yeah, that's right. If you don't join the National Guard and go get blown apart for nothing playing the IED lottery in your aluminum Humvee, why those of us in Texas would all be speaking Arabic right now. General Pace's remarks were erroneous on several counts. First, the website Iraq Coalition Casualty Count puts the number of U.S. service members killed since the beginning of the Iraq War in 2003 at 3,455. Now, this is old. It's 3,460-something now. The Pentagon only lists it as 3,400, 41, with 14 deaths not yet being confirmed by the Pentagon, with either number. The total number of fatalities long past the count of victims who died on 9/11. Second, the general overestimated the number of deaths on 9/11. The website September 11, 2001 victims states that 2,996 died in the attacks, rather than, quote, more than 3,000 murdered, that Pace cites. Finally, many of the victims who died on 9/11 were not American citizens. The aforementioned website lists 209 of the victims as foreign nationals. General Pace has previously referred to the number of fatalities in the war on terrorism surpassing the number of 9/11 victims. Quote, it is now almost 5 years since September 11, 2001, and the number of young men and women in our armed forces who have sacrificed their lives that we might live in freedom is approaching the number of Americans who were murdered on 9/11 in New York, Washington, D.C., and in Pennsylvania, Pace said in August 2006, according to a September 2006 CNN news report, when the number of troops killed in action in fact passed the number of 9/11 fatalities. So there you go. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, off by, give or take 500 dead Americans. We've almost lost as many Americans in Iraq as we did on 9/11, he says. When the last time that statement would have been true was last summer. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, lowballing the number of dead Americans from the Iraq war by nearly 500. I wonder who it is he's not counting. Is that your nephew? Is that your neighbor's son that didn't get counted by General Pace there?
Approaching 3,500 dead Americans.
Let's see if I can come up with more proof off of the top of my head that the military, that the brass, the officers, and particularly, obviously, it goes without saying, the civilian guys from the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and so forth, the little soft hand, no whisker having egghead civilian think tank pussies who sit around and come up with all these policies. Never even mind them. Okay, that just goes without saying that Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Pearl and Abe Schulsky and Eric Edelman and the rest of these criminals don't care. They don't care at all how many Americans die in these wars. So, anyway, that should have gone without saying. Sorry, I had to say it anyway. But General Pace, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, yeah, he doesn't care about you either. And you know what? The rest of the officers don't care about you either. You are cannon fodder to them. You're not a human being. You're a tool. You're a warm body whose job it is to, I don't know, go patrolling in an aluminum Humvee for nothing. Get blown up for nothing. Let's see if I can summon some more evidence for this. You ever heard of post-traumatic stress disorder? You know when something really bad happens? Have you ever been in a car wreck or something? And I guess if you've been in a really bad car wreck, you don't remember it, usually. But, goes to the same point. If you've been in a car wreck that's not quite that bad, you can remember it. Still, you don't think about it all that often, right? It kind of makes your heart jump if you do play it back in your head. Well, what happens with the post-traumatic stress disorder, these guys go through trauma, and rather than it kind of fading over time, and them healing from it over time, it gets worse and worse and worse over time. They can't ever stop thinking about those terrible things that happened, the people they killed, the friend whose pieces they held in their arms, etc., etc. And it's a terrible mental condition. It's the kind of thing that absolutely can be treated for people who have it. But the military doesn't believe in such a thing. No, they've just basically defined it out of existence as best they can. And we've done interviews to that effect on this show. Mark Bowl wrote an article, B-O-W-L, wrote an article for Playboy magazine about this, about how
Well, particularly those egghead neocons from the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and the American Enterprise Institute and so forth. They're the ones who came up with this theory that, there's no such thing as PTSD. There's no such thing as the shell shock these guys are dealing with. And so let's deny them benefits. Let's deny them treatment, etc. You may remember the clip. You may have seen on the internet the clip of Representative Obey, who recently sold you out on funding the Iraq war, castigating a lady in the hallway at the Capitol building who's saying, hey, you have the votes right now to stop the funding. What are you doing? Why won't you do it? And he said, oh, you idiot liberals want what we can't deliver. Just leave us alone. Remember that? Remember that, David Obey? Well, I forgot what I was going to say about David Obey. Something that pissed me off, but I got off on that tangent about that YouTube. Oh, I know what it was. That lady that he was screaming at in the hallway saying, you idiot liberals wanting us to end the war. We can't, okay? So we're just going to pass George Bush another blank check and you can piss off. That lady he was yelling at, her son had blown his own brains out. And when they found his body, he had in his pocket or laying there on the bed the paperwork denying him for treatment for his post-traumatic stress disorder. That was the final straw. Young man closes his eyes, sees dead friends, sees dead innocent people that, you know, he was involved in these battles. He gets a thing in the mail saying, sorry, no health care for you. That's that wonderful socialist government health care that everybody in America wants so bad. Nope, sorry, no health care for you. And the kid ate a pistol over it. That was the lady that Obey was screaming at in the hallway at the Capitol building. Hope I didn't screw that story up. I believe that's right. I guess I should go back and double check. And my partner in crime at Anti-War Radio, the great Charles Goyette, host of the morning show on 1100 KFNX in Phoenix, Arizona, he has interviewed twice this guy from The Nation magazine. I'm sorry if I can't remember that guy's name right off the top of my head. Let me see if I can look that up real quick. But there's an article from The Nation called How Specialist Town Lost His Benefits. And, the story's pretty short and sweet, how Specialist Town lost his benefits. He lost his benefits because the government decided that he had a personality disorder. Oh, sorry, you have a personality disorder. Joshua Kors, that's who is the author of the article. Joshua Kors, K-O-R-S, wrote the article for, and Charles interviewed him twice on this subject, wrote the article, How Specialist Town Lost His Benefits for The Nation magazine. And according to him, this has happened to thousands. We got, 30, 50, somewhere around there, 1,000 wounded? Don't even really know. In this story, Specialist Town, who was a decorated warfighting hero, had a mortar go off right over his head. And I guess he didn't have, I don't remember if he had any particular physical injuries. But, he certainly had problems. He was certainly wounded in a way. I think he had hearing loss and like severe concussion and maybe worse than that. But anyway, he got back to America and went to sign up for his health care. And they said, oh, I'm sorry, you have a personality disorder. Which, you know, if I say to you, you have a pen in your hand, well, we can measure that, can't we? You either do or you don't. But a personality disorder? Why, that sounds to me like it exists wholly in the eye of the beholder. Certainly many of you right now are rolling your eyes and saying, if there's anyone I know with a personality disorder, it's the guy on the microphone right now. But this is a definition of simply an abstract idea that exists nowhere in time or space, but only in the ether, only in someone's mind. can it be decided that someone else has a personality disorder. And if you have a personality disorder, no health care for you. Be strong. Be army strong. And if you get wounded, we will throw you in the goddamned garbage can to die. Army strong. Looking for a few good men to throw in a pile of garbage to die. So, anyway, please, don't believe them. Next time you watch an army ad on TV, why don't you do me a favor? Do yourself a favor and notice they don't ever show Iraq in these army ads. I read a thing not long ago where a kid asked a guy, hey, how'd you lose your leg? And he said, in the Iraq war. And the kid said, that's still going on? Yeah, you'd have never known that from watching army ads on TV, would you? Come on, guys, let's all go parachuting over what looks to be, you know, Tennessee or Arkansas or something down there. Yeah, ever since I joined the Army, they let me fly remote control planes every day. It's great fun. Be Army strong. Get blown apart and then get thrown in the garbage by your government that doesn't care if you fall down dead. This is Anti-War Radio. We'll be right back with Ivan Elin.
We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it?
I think this is a very hard choice, but we think the price is worth it.
Oh, sorry for the delay, folks. I gotta fix the damn music machine. Let me try now. Chaos Radio in Austin, Texas. Friends, welcome back to Anti-War Radio on Radio Chaos 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and welcoming back to the show, Ivan Elin. He's the director of the Center on Peace and Liberty at the Independent Institute. He's the author of Putting Defense Back in Defense Policy and The Empire Has No Clothes. His column runs Tuesdays at antiwar.com. Welcome back to the show, Ivan.
Thanks for having me back, Scott.
Well, very interesting article running on antiwar.com this week by you, my friend. Pakistan is going down the road of the Shah's Iran. Oh, no. We know what happened there.
Yes. Well, what happened there was that the U.S. was closely associated with a very repressive dictator, and finally the people overthrew the dictator, and of course there's been hatred for the United States ever since. But what many people don't know is that the U.S. is so unpopular that being a supporter of the Shah actually undermined him with his own people, because the U.S. superpower was, of course, very unpopular. And I think that's what's happening in Pakistan as well. Musharraf is very closely aligned with the U.S. in public, probably less so in private, since he's not really doing all that much to help us get bin Laden. But he's certainly taking our military assistance and that sort of thing. And so in the eyes of his people, he may actually have the worst of all worlds, because he's cuddling up to the U.S. and that's a very, and the U.S. is very unpopular in Pakistan because of its occupation of Afghanistan and Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Well, if we can put the shoe on the other foot, George Bush has an approval rating somewhere between 24% and 28% in America now. I guess it's fair to say that the American people don't favor him. But how would we feel if we all believed or knew for a fact that somehow he was just a puppet of Tony Blair or, you know, the government in Germany or something, if he was a foreign satrap over here being as lousy a president as he is? How would we feel then?
Well, that's the problem that the U.S. has. Whenever a U.S. supports a dictator, whether it's in Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, or Pakistan, it actually undermines their standing with their own people. These leaders find reasons to do that for other reasons, perhaps in Musharraf's case, because he gets a lot of military aid and that sort of thing. And he's also very concerned about, you know, having the U.S. on his side if he ever has a dust up with India, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But nonetheless, with his own people, oftentimes these leaders are, you know, imperiling themselves over time. And they don't think so in the short term. But then we see this recent incident in Pakistan where Musharraf suspended the chief justice. And there's been protests all over the country. And it really shows how fragile Musharraf is. And that was the same way with the Shah. He thought he was invincible. He didn't really care if his people liked the U.S. alliance, you know, that sort of thing. But in reality, the U.S. Alliance is part of the problem for Musharraf, because, you know, we are occupying Afghanistan and Iraq. And it's also a problem for the U.S., which our government doesn't see, and that is if Musharraf falls and Islamists take over, Pakistan is probably the most dangerous country on the planet, because it has nuclear weapons and it's very unstable.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned the mass protests over the firing of the Chief Justice. What was going on there? Do you know the story behind that?
Well, actually, something came out in the New York Times today about this. Apparently, Musharraf hauled in the Supreme Court Justice, got all of his military and intelligence generals in there, and tried to intimidate the Chief Justice to resign. And the Chief Justice says, no, I'm not going to do that. And, of course, the Pakistanis regard Musharraf, many of them, he said he was not going to hold both the generalship, the chief generalship, and the presidency, and he's reneged on that. And now he wants another five-year term, and he was worried that this chief judge, who is kind of sticks up for democracy, would make rulings that wouldn't allow him to have the parliament elect him for another five-year term. So this is very important to Musharraf to have the presidency for another 5 years. And so he got rid of the judge. And so now the question is, will the judge is going to be tried for malfeasance. But the real thing is not in the courtroom. It's what's going to happen in Pakistan. And I think we've already seen mass protests, and the Chief Justice has been leading them himself. And I think this is very... The outbreak of the protest was, I think, shocked Musharraf and shocked the United States as to how perilous Musharraf might be. And many people are now predicting that Musharraf might have to go.
Well, it definitely was something else. Seeing those protests on TV is something you never see in America. A bunch of guys in business suits out in the street protesting. It looked like, they look like all the Pakistanis I've ever met in America. That is, they have initials after their name representing advanced degrees and so forth. This was not poor downtrodden masses out in the street protesting. This was what amounts to the civil society of Pakistan.
Yes, I think there's a widespread support for this. The problem that I think the United States will have is if this whole movement gets hijacked by the Islamists, gets hijacked not by those guys in business suits, but the radical religious groups, which Musharraf has actually cultivated, and that's one of the reasons that we haven't apprehended bin Laden, because I think the Pakistani government probably does know where bin Laden is hiding. But if they turn him in, all hell could break loose. And I think even now, even without bin Laden being turned in, we have this mass movement, and the danger is that the Islamic parties could really gain control of any sort of situation.
Mm-hmm. And now, this is a point that you make in your article, that America could have chased bin Laden even into Pakistan, that Musharraf actually gave America a window of time that said, you know, if you have to use your soldiers to pursue bin Laden across the border for a limited amount of time, that's okay. But instead what we did was we basically let bin Laden go, but stayed in Afghanistan, right on the border, and because of that, all this pressure mounted on Musharraf that then he was put in the position, because we stayed, he was put in the position of having to cut a deal with these tribal warlord types on the border region. Is that right?
Right, because our presence there undermines him with these Islamic forces and the forces within his country, because as I mentioned, just like the Shah of Iran, the United States support is actually very unpopular with the people. We, as you mentioned, what the United States should have done was get bin Laden, capture or kill him, and then get out of there, because, and just say, listen, Pakistan and Afghanistan, you can have any government that you want, that your people want, or whoever, we don't care, but if you're supporting Al-Qaeda or bin Laden, we'll be back with a vengeance. And that's what should have been done, rather than the occupation, because now we have the worst of all worlds. We haven't rounded up bin Laden or the Al-Qaeda, the top leadership of Al-Qaeda, but we have this occupation, which is stirring up the very Islamist types that support bin Laden. So our policy is totally counterproductive, and we're caught in a quagmire in Pakistan in addition to the quagmires in Afghanistan and Iraq, except the quagmire in Pakistan is not U.S. soldiers on the ground, per se. It's support for this guy who, probably has going to have a short shelf life, I think, here.
Mm-hmm. Now, why do you think, Ivan, that the decision was made to really not even target Al-Qaeda, but instead to focus on overthrowing the Taliban and doing a regime change in Afghanistan, rather than chasing the guys that ordered those towers knocked down?
Well, I think, you know, it's just a case of mission creep. We see this with a lot of other military operations that happened during, from the first Bush to Clinton and Somalia, where they went and started to do nation building when it was a relief mission to start with. The same thing happened in Afghanistan. Our original mission should have been to capture or kill bin Laden, but we didn't put enough troops in there because of Rumsfeld's idea that, you know, we could do this with the new way of warfare was fewer troops on the ground, or using indigenous forces with U.S. air power. That was the model they were doing. Well, of course, these indigenous forces were paid off by bin Laden, so he escaped. And so they should have used U.S. forces. But there's also a problem that after that initial failure, the mission changed from capturing or killing to bin Laden to nation building to counterinsurgency when the Taliban was in resurgence because of the U.S. occupation. And now we're even into eradicate and stemming the drug trade, which is, of course, counterproductive to our main mission, because when we try to take people's livelihoods away from them, they then get livelihood from doing drugs illegally or moving them illegally, and therefore they recruit the Taliban to protect them, and that gives the Taliban money.
You mentioned in your article as well, and I guess this goes along with the guys in business suits protesting in the street, that that Musharraf is suppressing, well, I guess he's making deals with the Islamic parties, and he's suppressing the other secularist parties because they could probably beat them in the election. I think you mentioned two of these guys. He's refusing to let them even come back to Pakistan.
Right. The two former prime ministers, Bhutto and Sharif. And the problem that we have here is that, as in Iraq, we're supporting kind of a radical government against more moderate elements, because Musharraf, like Maliki in Iraq, is his base is some of the people that were, you know, could be potential enemies of the U.S., namely, you know, in the case of Iraq, radical Shiites. In the case of Pakistan, the radical Islamists that Musharraf depends on for support. And, you know, the very fact that we're supporting Musharraf and we're allowing him to suppress these alternative parties, we're doing exactly the same thing that we did in Iran with the Shah. We pull all our eggs in one basket, or ride one horse, so to speak, and we it's counterproductive. And I think it's especially counterproductive. At least the Shah was friendly to the U.S. It's not clear that Musharraf, with this need to get Islamist support, is actually very friendly to the U.S. He pretends like he is, but he certainly only does what he has to pretend like he's getting bin Laden and Zawahiri and the rest of the al-Qaeda people that are, who are probably somewhere in Pakistan. And also, Musharraf has caused a big problem with the resurgence of the Taliban in Afghanistan. The single biggest contributing factor to that is that the Pakistani army moved out of these wild areas and lawless areas in western Pakistan, where the Taliban originates from and crosses the border into Afghanistan. And the reason that the Pakistani army declared a truce with these groups is because Musharraf needed their support. So this has allowed the Taliban, Pakistani groups were supposed to suppress the Taliban and that sort of thing, but of course they haven't done that, and the Taliban attacks have increased in Afghanistan.
The regulators end up being controlled by those they're in charge of regulating, huh?
Right, exactly.
There is no regulation of the
Taliban now, and they're this truce Musharraf has with these groups has really contributed to the problems that the NATO coalition is facing in Afghanistan.
How many nuclear weapons does the state of Pakistan have, Ivan?
Well, that, you know, that's always hard to, you know, estimate. I mean, we don't even know how many for sure that Israel has, but which is a friendlier to us than even Pakistan. But they have probably, you know, maybe in the tens of nuclear weapons, not as many as their rival India, because they're behind them in nuclear capabilities, because India has more money and is a larger country. But they certainly have, they're not a nuclear superpower, but they do have a few nuclear weapons. I would estimate probably in the tens of weapons.
Mm-hmm. And now we've heard also that there's been a few different assassination attempts. I've heard numbers everywhere from 2 to 12 different near takings of Musharraf's life.
Yes, well, Musharraf has a curious relationship with the Islamic groups. He needs support from the Islamist parties, but at the same time, the most radical Islamists kind of regard him as a traitor because, of course, he's supported by the U.S., and so they try to assassinate him. Yes, there have been many attempts on his life, all unsuccessful. I think you will probably see those increase now in addition to the mass protests that he's getting.
Okay, well, let's pretend that somehow we could convince George Bush to make a clean break with the past and appoint you, Ivan Elin, as the new National Security Advisor of the United States. You have experience in government at the Congressional Budget Office and so forth, right? You're a serious foreign policy guy. He puts you in Stephen Hadley's chair and says, all right, Ivan, tell me what to do. What do you say? Do you tell him to take the army into Pakistan and get bin Laden and finish this thing?
Well, first thing you need to do is tell Musharraf that unless he, I give Musharraf one last chance and say, listen, we're not going to give you any more military aid, no economic aid, or any of these things that we give you if you just, if you don't come up with bin Laden soon. And then, you know, if he doesn't, then you pull that aid. And they, and you also say at the time, and after that, if you don't get him after that, then we're going to come in after him and do it ourselves. But the real thing about it is we don't want to occupy Pakistan, and we need to get out of Afghanistan. What we need to tell these countries is, listen, we're going to be very harsh on you if you're harboring people that are attacking the United States, but we're not going to tell you how to govern your country. We're not going to nation build. We're not going to interdict drugs. We're not going to fight the Taliban, because the Taliban in Afghanistan has come back because largely of the U.S. occupation. The Taliban had been pretty well discredited after the U.S. deposed it, but now it's coming back because of the hatred of the U.S. and all these bombings of civilians that that the United States has you know, all the collateral damage that our aircraft are causing. So I think what we need to do is focus. We need to get back. We need to roll back mission creep. We need to concentrate on bin Laden and Zawahiri and trying to get them out of there. Now, I wouldn't overstate that because I think al-Qaeda has become decentralized, so that's not going to eliminate the problem. But it would still be nice to get rid of them or capture them because they are responsible for 9/11. Obviously, capturing them and trying them is the best solution there, but sometimes that's hard to do when you have an armed, these people are armed to the teeth and they might fight to the death. So, but I think we've got to put that back at the top of this agenda, and we've got to say, we've got to stop these this nation building in Afghanistan. It's a futile attempt. I mean, Afghanistan has had decentralization for a long time. They haven't really had much of a central government. The people don't really want that much of a central government. And even the central government in Afghanistan now doesn't really govern very much. The warlords govern Afghanistan, and you can talk to them and say, listen, you know, what you do is your business, but if you harbor bin Laden or Zawahiri or any of the al-Qaeda people, we're going to come after you. And also you can tell that to Musharraf.
Yeah, it was the... It was the fear in this country that allowed the Bush administration to conflate al-Qaeda with the Taliban, even though we can all read in the London Independent, the Taliban actually sent a guy to D.C. a couple of weeks before the attack to warn us and was turned away. But it was because of our fear that our government was able to say al-Qaeda, Taliban, al-Qaeda, Taliban, al-Qaeda, Taliban, till they were just the same thing. And then they focused all their energy on the Taliban, and this is purely my speculation. I can't prove it to you, Ivan, and I know you can't read minds either, but I believe that the decision was made in the White House and in the military to deliberately let Osama bin Laden go at Tora Bora. They had 20,000 Marines ready to go. The New York Times reported in their article Lost at Tora Bora, 20,000 Marines were right there ready to go a few miles away from Tora Bora, and I believe they deliberately let him escape because they want that Goldstein. They want that enemy out there for all of us to do our 2 minutes hate and be afraid and let our government drag us into war after war after war. Here we are in Somalia now in the name of Osama bin Laden, who's exiled up there in the Hindu Kush somewhere.
Well, certainly bin Laden does provide a continuing threat, and certainly the Bush administration has taken advantage of that, both to invade Iraq and also to, nation build in Afghanistan to get additional bases in Central Asia, to get the bases in Iraq and Afghanistan, et cetera. So having an enemy out there does help the Bush administration and has certainly helped Bush get reelected in 2004 and still helps him to some extent, because the only thing that's really holding up any popularity at all for him is the people, I think, who still believe that the Taliban, or I mean Al-Qaeda, had something to do with Saddam Hussein. So, and of course, the Taliban is the same problem. After the 9/11 attacks, even after the 9/11 attacks, I think they could have done a better job of negotiating with the Taliban offline to try to give them to give up bin Laden.
Right. They did offer to give him up to fellow Arab state, another Arab state, which we could have had them turn him over to the Saudis or the Egyptians or the Syrians. They'd have tortured him all to death for us.
Well, I think, you know, the public ultimatum, they should have done more back channel, because any government that's confronted with an ultimatum usually resists it. And I think they should have done more offline to try to get them to give him up. But I think, you know, the Bush administration wanted to use this to go after Iraq. You can make the argument that they also wanted to go after Afghanistan.
I remember, you know, in the immediate wake of September 11th, the media obviously, to a great degree, was very cowed and afraid to criticize the administration. But at the same time, there were basically just reporters unleashed all over the world, and it was very hard to kind of centrally organize in the way that we see the media comes out now. You just kind of had, you know, let's go live to Joe in Tajikistan. What do you see, Joe? And I remember listening to NPR News in November. It must have been November of 2001. And Joe in Tajikistan is reporting that, man, there's Al-Qaeda everywhere here. These guys are Arabs. They're not Taliban. These guys are Arabs. And they're standing around. They're all around me. I just ate with them. Where the hell is the U.S. Army? The U.S. Army has a deal with the government in Tajikistan, you know? How come all these Al-Qaeda are standing here right in front of me? And, of course, we never heard a thing about that again. But it's just little things like that seem to me to betray the fact that they weren't really making an effort, that they had decided the enemy is the Taliban, not Al-Qaeda, in Afghanistan and surrounding areas.
Well, also, I think the record is pretty clear that they believe that 9/11 interrupted their quest to go after Saddam Hussein. So they were, you know, their first mission was to get to use 9/11 as an excuse to go after Hussein. And I think that, you know, when you put that in perspective, that 9/11 was, they had to go after Afghanistan first. So they approached it in the same way. And I think they did want to take down the Taliban. Because that's just the way they want to, as Rumsfeld said, they wanted to use the 9/11 attacks to transform the world. And, you know, certainly getting rid of the Taliban was, you know, was desirable from the U.S. perspective at the time, because the U.S. government didn't like the Taliban very much. And, you know, they were regarded as an outlaw regime. And so it was certainly easy to justify taking them out when they could have, perhaps negotiated a handover of bin Laden and avoided this whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it really goes to the title of your book, The Empire Has No Clothes. I think it's the case. I'm sure you'd agree with me that most Americans will immediately stick their fingers in their ears and start singing Mary Had a Little Lamb as loud as they can, rather than hear a fellow American tell them that their government maintains an empire, and that, well, for example, basing rights in Tajikistan or something, the fact that that could have a conflicting interest with catching the people responsible for killing all those American citizens is something that most people just can't wrap their head around. America could not possibly be an empire, and yet the title of your book implies that's exactly what it is.
Well, I think particularly in the conservative camp, conservatives don't like government, or at least they say they don't, until it comes to, you know, overseas engagement and, you know, beating other countries with the military stick. They somehow think that the U.S. government's not very effective here where it has at least some legitimacy, but they think it's going to be even more effective overseas where it has no legitimacy at all. So, and is regarded as a foreign invader and occupier. And so I think we really have gone away, again, from the principle function of the government, and conservatives should agree with this, is to defend our country. And certainly this empire is not defense of the country. In fact, it's quite the opposite. We're getting blowback from the empire on 9/11 and then afterwards. And, of course, Bush did the exact opposite of what he should have done. He dredged up more terrorism by launching other wars against the Taliban in Afghanistan and Saddam Hussein in Iraq. So this empire is certainly causing the blowback, and empire does not equal security, and in this case, it's making Americans less secure.
Mm-hmm. I remember a woman I met in 2002 telling me, well, I say we go get Saddam and get out. And I told her, lady, if they go and get Saddam, they're staying forever.
Yeah, that's what we do. It's the same thing. If they wanted to take down the Taliban because they felt that they were, you know, they were too prone to harbor bin Laden, they could have done that and gotten out as well. But they didn't. The propensity of the bureaucracies is to nation build. Let's make these countries like us, and, you know, make them have democracy and everything. And most of these countries are not ready for democracy yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, how did somebody who thinks so reasonably about foreign policy like you ever have a job in government advising people on such matters?
Well, I work for congressional agencies, and they're more independent. They do investigations, and in the case of the Congressional Budget Office, they provide alternative viewpoints and ways of doing things. So I've always had jobs that are kind of, even though they're with the government, they're sort of independent operators and that sort of thing. So they don't. None of the jobs I ever had with the government really bought into the policies necessarily of the government. It was more of a critique, an in-house critique of the policy. So
right, you're an oversight guy, basically.
Yeah, except that, you know, after you do oversight for a number of years, then you start asking yourself, as I did, why is the government doing this stuff in the first place? You know, because my reviews were limited to, well, could we do this a different way? And I reached a conclusion over the course of my work that perhaps we shouldn't be doing this stuff at all.
So really, you weren't already kind of a doctrinaire libertarian? You kind of just learned this from doing your job?
Yeah, I got my libertarianism from seeing how government actually operates from the inside. So, no, I was not a libertarian before I started working for the government.
So that's very interesting. So you're working in the Congressional Budget Office, and I guess basically you kind of came to the conclusion that you were just drawing out about conservatives and empire that, hey, wait a minute, the government isn't any more effective overseas than it is at home.
That's right. That's right. So I think, you know, libertarians are much more consistent than conservatives. Conservatives like overseas adventures. They like big law enforcement. They like, getting into people's social issues, what they smoke, what they do in the bedroom, et cetera. And I think, that's big government, too. And the liberals, of course, are less ashamed of being for big government. But we have basically two parties that are for big government. And at least the libertarians or the classical liberals, they seem to be more consistent for small government across the board. And that's why when I meet libertarians who are for this type of overseas intervention, I think that many libertarians don't really realize that war is the principal cause of big government throughout history, and the nation state was created for the purposes of warfare, and welfare was only added in the 19th century. So we had the warfare state before the welfare state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was sort of. I've always seen it as kind of. 100 years of welfare for the people who are already rich, mostly in terms of the war machine and such. And then around the turn of the last century, people decided, well, as long as there's going to be socialism for the millionaires, we ought to get some too, instead of taking the welfare away from the people who are already rich. And going back to the Constitution at that point, they made it doubly worse by falling for the same scam, supposedly to benefit themselves, being bribed with their own money.
Right, exactly. And I think that... you know, if you look at the figures, I think very little of the welfare goes to the poor people. We term it welfare when we give it to poor people. When we give it to rich people, it's, we're subsidizing a weapon system or a highway or agricultural crops, et cetera. we don't call it welfare or high protective tariffs for industry or whatever. But I think, you know, the problem with government is people think the government is a Robin Hood, gives from the, it takes from the rich and gives to the poor. But the people who really get benefits out of the government are the people who are best organized, and those usually tend to be the wealthiest people. Who should, there's nothing wrong with wealth as long as they earn it in the market and not use the wealth once they get it to get it on the cheap, get even more on the cheap from the government.
Mm-hmm. That's, you know, I never understood that Robin Hood analogy. Does nobody remember that story? It's about a group of outlaws who robbed the sheriff their tax money back. The sheriff came and looted what they had earned, and they ambushed him and stole it back. They were the government. It wasn't, Robin Hood wasn't a socialist. He was protecting people's property rights.
Right, but the liberals and the socialists use the Robin Hood example as a as to what the government should be doing, using tax money to take from the rich and give to the poor. That's their perverted analogy of the whole story.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let me ask you this. I'm not going to bother trying to give any of the what I deem to be excuses for American interventionism that are put forward here. But let me try to pitch to you, the most cynical defense of empire. I've been told this before, and I imagine, again, total make believe, but I imagine that if I was to, somehow get James Baker, alone and drinking and smoking and get him talking, that he would basically tell me, look, Horton, we have to have an empire, okay? Your standard of living comes from the American government looting people overseas. And the fact of the matter is, if we bring our Navy home and face it out off of our coasts and bring our Army home and leave them sitting at Fort Hood doing nothing with the only job of protecting this country and not going around enforcing empire on the world, that your standard of living, young man, is going to go through the floor. That it's a finite world, and if the U.S. government does not steal from people on behalf of our tribe here or whatever, then we're going to lose out. So it's either us or them, and it's going to be us.
Well, of course, you would get that from many policymakers in Washington, not just James Baker, but they've all been inculcated with the idea that government is the one that produces wealth. And really, I think the classical economists have shown that empire does not pay. It's better to spend the money buying what you need overseas rather than sending the U.S. military over to guard the oil or whatever else. And empire is very expensive because you have to have huge military forces. They have to be deployed around the world, which is expensive, and you have to have bases for them and all that sort of thing. And of course, we're in the position of where we're sacrificing our allies, will hold hostage, imagine this, our right to defend them so that they can get even more concessions. For instance, the Japanese, to keep our military bases in Japan to defend the Japanese, we have had to reduce our pressure on the Japanese to open their market because they have a somewhat closed market. And so here we are. What do we get? And the same thing with the Europeans. They don't totally open their market to our goods. And the reason that they can get away with that is because we need those bases to defend them. And that's kind of a weird thing to do, a weird way to negotiate. But this empire is very valuable to the policymakers here in Washington because it's driven by domestic interests that are feathered by it. And the general population would be better off economically. And in fact, if you were talking to James Baker, you could say, well, I don't think that's right. I think if we reduce defense spending and to only what we need to defend our country, and we didn't have spend all this money on empire and that sort of thing, we'd be wealthier because we could return some of this money to the private sector.
So really, the American people as a whole lose out from all this empire. It's just money going out and not coming back, but for certain interests, say a particular oil company here or a certain airplane manufacturer there, they get to cash in, and so the rest of us are made to suffer for their private special interests, as Ross Perot used to call them.
Yeah, I think that's right, and you can say that about any government program, whether it's transportation, welfare, building weapons systems, foreign policy. The groups drive the policy because they're more well-organized, so it benefits certain groups to have these policies. But the general taxpayer and citizen is disadvantaged because of these policies. And unfortunately, the taxpayers and the citizens aren't as well-organized as the pressure groups.
Mm-hmm. I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio, and I'm talking with Ivan Eland. He's the director of the Center on Peace and Liberty at the Independent Institute and writes every Tuesday for us at antiwar.com. And I want to talk about progress for the future. I want to talk about the new realignment, Ivan Eland. I see that you've now joined with Bob Perry at Consortium News, and that's just the kind of left-right realignment, and particularly in terms of great investigative journalism and policy recommendations and stuff. So why don't you tell me a little bit about Consortium News and whether you think that portends perhaps a better future for maybe even a chance of a realignment of the real anti-war left and the real anti-war right to come together to put a stop to this madness?
Well, I think I don't really have a close association with them. I think they may reprint some of my stuff.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought this was a whole new this was a project that you were working with them on and everything.
No, not really. But I think I do support their efforts because I think, you know, what we need to do is get the old right and the new left together and to forge a coalition, because unfortunately both of those groups are a minority within their own party. Both parties are very interventionist, and I think it's a good idea to speak to people across the spectrum and say, listen, and that's what my book attempts to do. I have a chapter on why conservatives should be against empire, a chapter on why liberals should be against empire, and another chapter on why everybody else should be against the empire. So I think you need a broad-based push to educate the public on why empire is bad. And I think that the problem was illustrated during the Republican debate when Ron Paul said very convincingly to me, and I think to some other people who've studied these things, that, you know, we are... 9/11 was blowback for our empire. Well, of course, Rudy Giuliani gave him a dressing down, and you know, saying, you know, this, I don't remember exactly the exact words, but it's basically that, you know, that's preposterous, and you know, blah blah blah. Well, of course, the media covered this as the coverage implied. Well, yes, Ron Paul is kind of a kook, but Rudy Giuliani shouldn't have been mean to him, and that's the type of thing. You know, Ron Paul is dismissed as some sort of a kook or a nice eccentric congressman. Whereas his logic, if you follow his logic, it's very right on target. But nobody bothers with that because it's such an unorthodox and unconventional view. And I think Ron Paul has had activities with people on the left that were anti-war, and I think we all ought to, you know, join with that, because we need to get people to think about the issues rather than to just, you know, agree with Rudy Giuliani that, oh, that's a preposterous thing to even fathom, because we're Americans and we never do anything wrong, or we never do anything that other people could take revenge for.
Mm-hmm. And now you're one of the people who in the 1990s predicted that America would be attacked again here at home because of our foreign policy, aren't you?
Yes. In 1998, I did a report when I was with the Cato Institute that said, you know, if we continue this foreign policy meddling, we are going to face a catastrophic attack. And in this report, I documented over 60 cases of where acts of terrorism followed U.S. foreign policy or were caused by U.S. foreign policy. And I was pretty, you know, conservative about what I put in there. If the terrorist attack, the cause of it was in any way murky, I didn't put it in there. But so those 60 cases are pretty solid, I think, and it's really empirical evidence. And then I actually updated it for the American Prospect last year, which is a liberal publication. So they got me to update the you know, from my 1998 report. So Yes, unfortunately I predicted, but of course even after 9/11 we did the exact opposite, and we didn't do a restrained foreign policy, which the president promised. In fact, we went 180 degrees and we became a hyper aggressive in the world.
Yeah, well, maybe after the next attack they'll finally listen to you, Ivan.
Well, you know, it's really the problem with these attacks is it took several years for the raw emotion of having 3,000 people killed. You know, the emotional, first response is to lash out and say, wow, these people are evil. And yes, they are evil. Anybody who kills civilians is evil. But you have to ask yourself, what's driving this? And could we in any way be responsible? And I shouldn't use the term we, because people always say to me, well, are you saying, we, the victims, were responsible for this? Or they say, are you saying the victims in that tower were responsible for this? And I'm not going there. I think that what's really the case is we need to distinguish between the U.S. citizens, which are the victims of this, but there are victims first of bin Laden, but second of their own government's actions, which bin Laden is retaliating against. We ought to ask if those government actions are really needed overseas, and that gradually and quietly we can retract the empire. But unfortunately, we have to deal with the causes of the empire, and I think the causes are domestic, and that these pressure groups get certain benefits from these, and that you have your military bureaucracies who need a mission to guard oil, even though the market will probably produce the oil without any military protection, simply because oil is a valuable commodity, and even radical regimes like the Iranian regime need money, so they'll sell it. So, these types of things, we need analysis, not just pressure group pressure.
Right. All right. Well, thank you very much for your time today, Ivan. I sure appreciate it.
Everybody. Thanks, Scott.
Ivan Eland, he's the director of the Center on Peace and Liberty at the Independent Institute, and writes The Empire Has No Clothes every Tuesday for antiwar.com. We'll be right back.
Talking at me, never listen to a word I said. Always yap, yap, yapping.
right, y'all. Welcome back to Anti-War Radio. I'm your host, Scott Horton. This is Chaos Radio, 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. Also 92.7. Really comes in a hell of a lot better there. Streaming worldwide, live on the internet, KAOS959.com. Thanks very much for tuning in. Let's talk about Iran. Pretty much every day on this show, I do my best to debunk the two biggest lies about Iran. The first is that Iran is responsible for the violence against American soldiers in Iraq. That's just not true. The vast majority of American casualties in Iraq come from fighting the Sunni Arab-based insurgency. They are armed and financed by our friends, the Saudis, not Iran. America has fought two actual pitched battles, real battles, against Shiites. The Mahdi Army, that was in April and August of 2004, 3 years ago. And I don't know whether it's an absolute fact, although I think it's very probable that Muqtada al-Sadr and his Mahdi Army get some training and some weapons from Iran. Why not? But that doesn't mean that they're getting them from the Iranian government. And even if it does, these groups are really not the enemy. America clamps down on the Mahdi Army to a degree, but the Mahdi Army is part of the government. He withdrew some of his members of the government, but not all of them. He's part of the United Iraqi Alliance, and more importantly, has been. The other political leadership among the Shiites are really the Dawa Party and the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq. And they very well may be trained and backed by the Iranians too, since the Ayatollah Khomeini created those organizations and they lived in Iran for 30 years. But if Iran is arming them, America doesn't owe them anything but thanks, I guess, because the U.S. government has decided these are the factions we're backing. The Iranian factions. So when they say, hey, Iran, stop arming the militias, you mean the same ones that our guys are arming? Why? They're just helping. But they're just vague, and they say, well, there's Iranian bombs in Iraq somewhere, and that's good enough. Well, it's not. And in fact, the quote-unquote Iranian bombs are the EFPs. Now, you know, you all know of the IEDs, those are the improvised explosive devices, but the EFPs are not quite so improvised. They're put together in a bit more professional manner, and they're so much more effective because they shoot a molten core of copper up through the floorboard of whatever car is being bombed, or armored vehicle is being bombed. They have a whole new acronym, the EFP, the Explosively Formed Penetrator. And all the smear since January has been that these must be coming from Iran. They must be. Well, that's not true, that they must be. To the degree that they are coming from Iran, that still doesn't prove that the Iranian government is behind it. The fact that they're ending up in the hands of the Sunni insurgency, which is fighting, refusing to accept the authority of the elected Iranian parties, wouldn't make too much sense for Iran to be arming the Sunni insurgency. Certainly, you know, weapons are a fungible resource, basically, and can be traded and bought and sold from all different sides, more than you could probably be able to identify. So I guess it's possible that the Sunnis are getting their hands on some of these bombs as per the assertions. But the Reuters news agency and the Christian Science Monitor both reported and quoted Lieutenant Colonel Scott Blackwell. I blogged it on antiwar.com under the title Washington Post Liars Caught, not by me, by some other much more prominent bloggers. I think it was Digby, who found where the Washington Post reprinted the Reuters story But cut out the part about how Scott Blackwell, Lieutenant Colonel Scott Blackwell, reported that in Diwania, which is about 100 miles south of Baghdad, they had found a factory supposedly under the control of the Mahdi Army, Muqtada al-Sadr's group, a quote-unquote factory where they made these explosively formed penetrators. That was in the Reuters article. The Washington Post cut that out and replaced it with a paragraph about how two soldiers died from roadside bombs today. One of them was from an EFP, which the White House says come from Iran. The Washington Post cut out the part that said we found a factory that makes these things 100 miles south of Baghdad in Iraq, and replaced it with a paragraph saying the White House makes accusations that say Iran's behind it then, if somebody died from an EFP. So it's not just your government lying to you, it's the media lying to you, mostly through vagueness, through half-truth, and glittering generalities and so forth. But it is not a fact that an EFP, explosively formed penetrator, super sophisticated IED, must come from Iran. And it's also not true that the Shiite factions who are backed by Iran to varying degrees are the ones fighting the U.S. soldiers, when in fact they're not. Okay? So there's one. Two, I try my very best to debunk on this show all the time, and that is Iran's nuclear weapons program. TV over and over and over again. Although less so now, I think somebody must have busted their chops. Wish I could take credit. For the most part, still, I think, they refer to Iran's nuclear weapons program. What is going to be done about Iran's nuclear weapons program? The UN Security Council is going to vote today about new sanctions over Iran's nuclear weapons program. That's the way the news is always reported. But the fact is, there's no evidence at all anywhere on Earth, or at least in the hands of any Western sources that are worth anything, that says that Iran even has a nuclear weapons program. What they have is a nuclear program which is monitored by the United Nations, by the International Atomic Energy Agency, under a mandate from the non-proliferation treaty, which Iran is a member of, and they have guys on the ground in Iran. They have cameras up, and on top of that, Iran's equipment is a bunch of crap that they bought at AQ Khan's garage sale. It's AQ Khan's rusted old used car that was sitting out in the backyard. They have first-generation Urenco centrifuges, and they're pieces of crap, according to my best source on such matters, Dr. Gordon Prather. But it's also clear that the Mossad and the CIA have no evidence at all of a secret nuclear program. The only nuclear program that exists in Iran that anybody has evidence of is the one that everybody has evidence of. So, and just last week, the director of the IAEA, Mohammed El-Baradei, who told you that Iraq did not have an advanced nuclear weapons program, or in fact a nuclear weapons program of any kind at the beginning of 2003, remember him? He says there somewhere between 3 and 8 years. And 3, I think, is because for some reason he's decided to be extra generous to the accusers in the West. Everybody else seems to agree that if Iran was to kick out the IAEA and begin trying to figure out how to enrich uranium to a high enough percentage of uranium-235 to make a nuclear bomb out of it, that it would take them a decade if they were to begin trying now. So, as Scott Ritter, former UN weapons inspector, told you on this show, the policy is regime change, disarmament is the excuse. And now, lie number three, I think we pretty much always neglect to confront. And that is that Ahmadinejad, first of all, is the guy in charge, which he's not. The Ayatollah Khamenei is in Iran. But second of all, that he has vowed to wipe Israel off the map. That is just not true. And we ran an article over the weekend, I think it was, maybe it was Monday, on antiwar.com about this big lie. The actual translation, there have been people who've come to my blog, thestressblog.com, in the comments section and did the translation for me from Farsi. In Ahmadinejad's statement, he did not use the term Israel, Iran, wipe, or map. We're going to wipe Israel off the map, is the translation, but somehow, that's funny, because he didn't even say Israel, wipe, or map in the sentence at all. What he was doing, Ahmadinejad was quoting the dead Ayatollah Khomeini and saying the regime, that is the government of Israel, must be removed from the face of the earth or some vague type thing like that. And interestingly enough, it was actually the Iranian press office that sent out the bad translation first. It was the Iranian government's fault. They sent out the bad translation. The whole speech is there in Farsi, and people who know how to translate into proper English will now testify to you. It does not say wipe Israel off the map. It doesn't say that. But the Iranian press office screwed it up the first time, and so now that's the legend that will exist forever. And the fact that Iran has the most marginal navy and air force, probably in the whole world, the fact that they have no ability to wipe Israel off the face of anything, other than, you know, maybe an actual paper map that they have in their office somewhere, is supposed to be besides the point, right? It's just like me, threatening Mike Tyson. He's supposed to, he's allowed to kill me now because it's a credible threat I just made about against him, right? Although that guy's such a basket case, who knows? Maybe I could take him, but, yeah. So there you go. Three big lies to justify war in Iran. That Iran is necessarily behind the roadside bombs, the new and improved roadside bombs, and that they are the ones fighting Americans in Iraq. Big lie one. Big lie two, Iran is on the verge of having nuclear bombs. Big lie three, they vow that as soon as they get those bombs, they're going to kill every Israeli in Israel. All lies. Remember that when the bombs start falling. It's just not true what our government says. And I'm not trying to be, the great defender of Iran. Jesus Christ. Place is a horrible theocracy. I'm sure it's, a pretty horrible place to live for a lot of people under the repression of their total state. I'm not the defender of their state. I'm the accuser of mine, which tells nothing but lies to justify aggressive warfare.
My friend, but you're I'm old enough to know better, out of control. Keep trying to hold on while my youth just slips away. My reflection in the mirror seems to be getting old.
All right, my friends, welcome back to Anti-War Radio. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and I'm joined on the phone now by Warren Ritchie, a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. Welcome to the show, Warren.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Oh, it's very good to have you on here. Big fan of your paper. You guys tend to not just go along with whatever the AP would have us believe a lot of the time, and I appreciate that.
Well, we try to call it the way we see it.
Yeah, and I really mean that. You know, especially ever since the run-up to the Iraq War, I found a lot of really, really good reporting in the Christian Science Monitor. Very valuable paper. And your recent article is a great example of that. My understanding is you've been in Miami from the beginning of the Padilla trial up until yesterday. Is that right?
Yeah. That's right. I'm actually in Washington D.C. right now, but yeah, I have been in Miami covering the Padilla trial.
Okay, and let me just remind the audience really quickly, for those who don't remember Jose Padilla. He was arrested in 2002 on a material witness warrant. John Ashcroft, live from Moscow, announced that he was an enemy combatant and had been turned over to the Navy. Turns out a judge in New York had demanded to see he wasn't accused, the witness, and rather than let the judge see him, they turned him over to the Navy. And then fast forward to just last year, I think it was, the beginning of last year, the end of 2005 maybe, the Supreme Court was about to hear his case, and legal experts agreed that the Supreme Court was probably going to rule that this guy had to get a trial in a civilian federal criminal court, just like anybody else, an American citizen arrested on American soil. So rather than fighting it in the Supreme Court, the administration decided to take his standing away in that case, and they did that by going ahead and indicting him in federal court for conspiracy to commit acts of terrorism and so forth. And he's now on trial in Miami for with two other defendants on terrorism charges. And apparently, correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Ritchie from the Christian Science Monitor, but the original accusations that Jose Padilla was going to set off a radioactive dirty bomb and or blow up high-rise apartment complexes here in America, those charges do not appear anywhere in the indictment or in this case. Is that right?
Well, that's right. And the charges in Miami aren't actual terrorism charges. They're material support and conspiracy charges. Now, that doesn't make much difference if he's convicted, because all of these three men, if they're convicted of all the charges, will face potential life in prison. But there is a difference between blowing up something and conspiring to blow something up. Now, the thing that's interesting about the Miami case is that it's primarily a material support case, meaning that they did something to help the alleged terror groups overseas to commit terrorism. And what they're alleged to have done is provide money and recruits and material to those organizations. In addition, and this is a really important part of this case, they're alleged to have conspired with these groups to commit murder and to maim people and to kidnap people through those violent acts overseas. So even though it's a conspiracy charge, and frequently people think that it's easy to prove a conspiracy, there's going to have to be some kind of proof showing that these men who are on trial planned to participate in those violent activities.
Mm-hmm. I'm no legal expert at all. I haven't been trained in a single day of law school. But when I read the Padilla indictment, and it's been since it came out, since I've read it, but when I read it, the impression I got was, oh, so these guys knew a guy who knew a guy who went and fought in the Holy War in Chechnya or something? Is that basically what this case amounts to, is some degrees of separation between somebody who did something and somebody who knew him?
Well, let me back up a little and answer something that you asked earlier. One of the one of the reasons you don't see, you know, initially everyone knows Jose Padilla as the so-called dirty bomber, the guy who was plotting with Al-Qaeda to detonate a radiological bomb somewhere in the United States. Those allegations aren't in any court filing. They're not in this case, not because people in the government don't believe that that's what was going on. It's because of the way the U.S. government obtained that information. It was obtained from individuals who were in CIA black sites overseas, through methods that have been less than clear. One of the sources of the information has alleged that he was tortured. In fact, maybe three of them have alleged that they were tortured, and that the information that they give, that they gave concerning Padilla was obtained under torture. Now, those are their allegations, and it's unclear whether, in fact, there was torture, but there's no doubt that those questions were answered under coercive conditions. And in the U.S. criminal justice system, coercive information obtained under coercive means can't be admitted in a court of law because it's generally unreliable. And that, you know, the thinking is that if you hurt somebody bad enough, they'll say anything to make you stop hurting them. And so our justice system is designed as, at least notionally, it's a search for truth. And if you're searching for truth, then you want people to say the truth. And you want the government to be working toward establishing the truth. And so the evidence that came overseas, came from overseas that led to those statements by former Attorney General Ashcroft and others can't be admitted in a court of law because of how they were obtained. Now, in addition, there was information that was obtained from Mr. Padilla himself, and that was also obtained regardless of whether or not he has alleged that he was tortured while he was in military custody. And it's unclear at this point whether, in fact, he was or wasn't. Or, but what is clear is that the conditions under which he was held and interrogated were coercive. And so those statements can't be admitted in court as well. So the government is left with the difficult task of having to cobble together a case with evidence obtained in other ways, evidence that's the kind of methods that, you know, we usually see in important cases in U.S. courts. And that's why the indictment is somewhat thin.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I guess are we assuming then that it would be more substantial if they were allowed to use some of this other information, or you think that this is really all they have because the rest, if they got it under duress, it's probably not true anyway.
Well, it depends. You know, you could debate this. Well, you know, what if the government brought everything in? What if they said, okay, here's everything we got, and we're going to let the defense fully explore how these witnesses were treated? Well, it would depend on how the jury considered that information. And you can think about it on yourself. If you were sitting on the jury and someone came in and said, well, I, you know, did this to an individual, and just prior to this individual saying this information, I mean, you'd want to know whether that information was reliable or not. You might want that individual to come into court in front of you and say, do you now stand by those statements? In other words, you could bring them in later and say, okay, you're not being tortured now. What you said then, was it true?
Right.
And, you know, that would be one way to...
Well, is the defense asking for that? Is the defense trying to get these people to come in? Or I guess it's not admissible because it's not part of the prosecution's case at this point, right?
No. Well, the government really hasn't doesn't want to open that door. The government doesn't want to go down there. They want to keep that part. They don't want anybody looking at what has been what has happened behind the scenes with these individuals in terms of counterterrorism interrogations. They just want to keep keep that door closed.
Mm-hmm.
And the government has said, we won't bring that stuff in. And then the defense now has tried to bring some of it in, but the mm-hmm. judge has ruled against the defense in those areas. And so the trial really is confined to some extent so far. I mean, this is one reason to watch this case very closely, is to see if any of these doors open
mm-hmm.
by anybody. If the government tries to bring some of this information, that'll be an important thing that should be watched very closely and reported on.
Mm-hmm.
But so far, it looks like they're going to focus on, the limited amount of evidence in the public record, and so it means that it's an interesting case from the perspective of the government kind of has a hand tied behind its back, and so we'll have to see what the jury does.
Right. Well, and as you say, the defense in a way does too. They've tried to get some of this information in, and I believe, as you said, the judge has ruled against them. My understanding was that the judge has said basically that anything that has to do with Padilla's custody or the time he spent held in the custody of the U.S. Navy, whether he was tortured or anything else, it has nothing to do with this case. Just because the Navy tortured him doesn't affect the Department of Justice's case here, and so the defense may not bring up any of that.
That's right. And there is a counter-argument, of course, and the defense, one of the arguments that the defense makes is that that's not entirely true. When you take someone and hold them for a period of years, Mr. Padilla was held for 3 years and 8 months in military detention, and for much of that time was held without access to a lawyer. They say that that because of that treatment, he has been unable to assist them fully in his defense, and so they're basically saying that their ability to defend him has been prejudiced by this pretrial detention without access to a lawyer, access to his family and others.
Now, it seems kind of unfair for the judge to say, oh, well, the poor Justice Department, it's not their fault. I mean, the Attorney General and the Secretary of Defense are both members of the same cabinet, right? It's not that he was arrested in some foreign country and held by him this whole time.
Yes, but it's the government. That's why it's the government that has conceded that it won't bring in this other information
mm-hmm.
that they obtained through intelligence. And so they're sort of saying, okay, we're going to pay the price. And this... And your description earlier was correct, that what's happening here is they were holding him as an enemy combatant completely outside of the criminal justice system. And so so those protections that are there for criminal defendants didn't really apply to him. Although he did have some very fine lawyers working on his behalf to raise this constitutional issue to the Supreme Court. It was only on the eve of the Supreme Court potentially taking this case that the Justice Department then moved him into the criminal justice. That the Defense Department and the President redesignated him so that he could be moved into the criminal justice
mm-hmm.
system. And so then you get a situation where the prosecutors have to scramble with whatever evidence they can get.
Right. And now, right now, we're still at the state's part of the trial, and the defense hasn't had their turn yet, right?
That's right. Yeah, the government's case is supposed to last, I don't know, several months.
Several months. Okay. Well, I wonder if you're familiar at all with the story. And I'm sorry, I wish I had remembered earlier and looked up the man's name, but there was a news story that said that the FBI agent, direct quotes from the FBI agent who originally detained Padilla on a material witness warrant, that he was trying to flip Jose Padilla and make him the center of a sting operation to set off a radioactive dirty bomb, and that Padilla said no. And then they decided he was an enemy combatant and turned him over to the Navy in the name of he was part of a plot to set off a dirty bomb. But there's direct quotes from the FBI agent who was originally handling the case who said, "I didn't think he was a danger at all. I wanted to use him to set up a sting operation."
Mm. Now, I haven't seen the... I've seen who those agents are and what they wrote, but I haven't seen those statements. But it sounds... I don't know that they wanted to set off the dirty bomb, but I do know that the agents, when they first approached Padilla at the airport...
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to say that they wanted him to actually set off a bomb,
okay,
but that they wanted him to set up a plot to set off a bomb, and then they would be heroes and make a bust and that sort of thing.
Well, I think what they were doing, what they were interested in doing is if they could have flipped Padilla, so to speak, if they could have gotten Padilla to work with them, they would have used him to uncover the rest of the plot. Because remember, when Padilla comes into the country, the government thinks that there's an ongoing plot to detonate a dirty bomb or blow up apartment buildings. They don't know what's out there. They don't know who else is out there. They don't know that there aren't, like the 9/11 attack, that there might not be 10 other or 15 other people out there, and that all they need is Padilla to show up and then boom, another 9/11 happens. That they're operating. I mean, you know, in fairness to the government, they don't know what they don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he comes in, they sit him down, and it's really kind of a pretext because he comes into the country with something over $10,000 that he's carrying, and he'd reported about $8,000, and so they say, well, you know, you violated the law because you didn't report the correct amount, when in fact, you know, he wasn't, it doesn't seem like he was trying to sneak into the country with a huge amount of money. I mean, he had a lot of money, but he reported that he had a lot of money.
Right.
If he really is a terrorist coming into the country, $8,000 is, you know, might be enough to do what he wants to do. But anyway, they sat him down and they wanted to gather as much information as they could, and they wanted to gauge whether or not he would be cooperative or not. And so they asked him a series of detailed questions. They already know that he's been overseas and where he's been, but they don't entirely know what he's up to.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they determined that he wasn't going to be cooperative, then they read him his rights, his Miranda rights, and they then used their material witness warrant to take him into custody. And, you know, when they do that, a material witness warrant sounds very benign. It sounds, oh, well, they just want to hold him for the grand jury. But in fact, that's not how material witness warrants have been used in the war on terror. They've really been used as a mechanism to really frighten people into cooperating with the government. They want to show you that they can basically destroy your life. And if you want to cooperate, great. If you don't, well, then this is what you're going to face. Because immediately he goes into the high security wing of the detention facility in New York. Strip searches and the whole thing. I mean, there's nothing subtle about any of this. It's you either help us or we're going to make your life very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it all started.
That's quite a contrast. I mean, you have to admit, I found the quote here. "I didn't want to arrest him," said Special Agent Russell Fincher. "I needed his cooperation." He said the agency had hoped Padilla could provide information about an al-Qaeda plot to detonate a radioactive device, or so-called dirty bomb, on U.S. soil, and needed an insider. So from, "I didn't want to arrest him, I thought that he was, could probably be useful and wasn't so dangerous, that we could use him in a sting operation," to go from there to, "This guy is so dangerous that he doesn't get a trial, we turn him over to the Navy," is... I think that's pretty shocking, particularly when the fact that, quote, "I didn't want to arrest him" doesn't come out until July 2006. after this guy's been in custody, being, as we now know, under the no-touch torture expertise of the CIA and the military while he was in the brig there. This is an American citizen arrested unarmed on American soil. They wanted to use him as a snitch.
Well, yeah, they wanted him to identify who else was in the country because they thought there was an ongoing plot to there was a weapon of mass destruction, or there soon might be a weapon of mass destruction, that there were others who might be even more capable than Padilla to carry it out. And so they were operating under the assumption that there was an ongoing plot. Now,
well, and apparently they were also operating under the assumption that this guy's not so dangerous that we can't let him out on the street.
Oh, well, I'm not sure about that because remember they had another option. They didn't have to exercise the material witness warrant. They could have let him go. They could have said, "Well, okay, you didn't report this extra amount of money, we're going to let you slide this time." And then they keep him under surveillance. But you know what I mean?
Well, I mean total surveillance.
And so they can identify who else he goes to see. And
sure. Well, what I mean, I'm sorry, you might misunderstand. I probably didn't say it very clearly. But basically what I mean is that if he had said, okay, fine, I'll be your snitch on the inside of this plot or whatever, then if he had agreed to go along, they presumably would have let him go out the door.
Oh, well, yeah, but they would have kept him under complete. I mean, they would have really watched him. If he had gone, and there would have been a series of, they do that all the time in drug cases.
Sure, sure. I understand. But, you know, in a drug case, it's not the same thing as this guy was going to nuke us, and so we have to turn
him over
to the Navy to be tortured. You know?
That's correct.
I mean, this is, even in America, we take the most heinous child killers, and we give them fair trials. We don't turn them over to the Navy to be tortured. And particularly when you're talking about a guy who apparently they were willing to trust him to be, their inside guy, to go undercover for them or whatever.
Yeah, but they would have, I don't know that they would have trusted him. They would have used him to uncover the rest of the plot, and then they would have probably put him into the brig in South Carolina.
Right. And I'm sorry, I'm beating a dead horse to death with all that. Let's move on to some of the particulars of this trial. I remember, I guess, a week or two ago, they talked about this job application that Padilla had filled out, and yet there were questions raised by the government's own witnesses as to whether this implicated him in being a member of Al-Qaeda or not.
Yeah, it's very interesting because this is a key, this is one of the pillars of the government's case. It's called a Mujahideen. It's what the government calls a Mujahideen data form. And apparently when you arrive at or when you're approaching the Al-Farouq camp, at least this is how it's been presented at the trial, you are presented with an application. And the application asks for all kinds of information, personal information, your name and your parents' name and your address and, that kind of thing. And his name, it was filled out in a name that he was believed to be using at the time. It wasn't filled out as Jose Padilla because it was filled out under, I think it's Muhajir al-Muhajir, the immigrant, was just a kind of a pseudonym that he was using at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting about this document and some of the information in it, corresponds, it's Jose Padilla's birthday and, his date of birth. And, it indicates that this particular individual speaks both English and Spanish, because Padilla is of Puerto Rican heritage, and so he also spoke Spanish. So there are similarities, but the defense, of course, that it's the defense job to try to raise reasonable doubt in the minds of the jurors, and to force the government to prove its case. And so the defense it points out that there are two different kinds of ink used in the filling out of this form, that it appears that it's been completed by more than one person. And the real interesting evidence presented by the government, you know, in their opening statement to the jury, they said, you know, we've got this Mujahideen data form, and we have proof that Padilla filled it out because his fingerprints are on the form. Well, you know, I mean, I've covered a lot of trials. That's pretty good evidence. His fingerprints are on the form. Well, it turns out on cross-examination by the defense, they ask the government's own fingerprint expert, okay, now where are these fingerprints? Well, the fingerprints, turns out, are on the first page and the last page. The defense attorney has the expert hold a copy of these documents in the way that would have resulted in the fingerprints. And it's essentially, if I handed you, it's a five-page form. If I handed you the form and said, is this your form, and you took a hold of it, that's how you get the fingerprints.
Right, like eight on the bottom and two on the top, thumbs on top and fingers on the bottom kind of thing?
Yeah, it's thumb on the top and a thumb on the back. And defense is suggesting to the jury is that, and eventually they'll argue this, I suspect, that Padilla might have been handed this form at a later time, like when he was in custody in the military brig.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in fact, the fingerprints don't prove that he filled out the form, or that the prints were made at the time he filled out the form. They prove that at some time he held the form.
Well, and didn't they also have one of the prosecution witnesses say that, who was supposed to say that, yes, this application definitely means that he's a member of Al-Qaeda or something, but then didn't he admit under cross-examination that when he filled out his version of the application, he was then given a choice? Are you sure you want to join Al-Qaeda? So that this doesn't necessarily mean he had even done anything.
That's right. That witness was Yahya Goba, who is an American Muslim who went to over and went to the Al-Farouq training camp and went through the training. And he came back to the United States and was living in the U.S. and was working quietly and was discovered by the FBI and pleaded guilty to providing support to Al-Qaeda and is now serving a 10-year prison sentence. And so he's cooperating to reduce his sentence. And as part of his cooperation, he's agreed to go to various trials and testify about his experiences. And so, yeah, he testified that he filled out a similar form just before he went into the Al-Farouq camp. But the odd thing about his testimony is he said, oh, yeah, but everything I put on that form, with a few exceptions, was false information. And he said he had been advised to do that to protect himself. And so it raised questions about the importance of this form as a sort of document that would lead to, operations with Al-Qaeda.
Sounds pretty thin to me.
Well, it's, you know, a lot of it depends on how the jury views this. The jury may completely accept the way the government is putting together its case, or the jury may completely be aligned with the defense, or, which is most likely, the jury at this point is somewhat conflicted. Because there's some evidence going one way and there's some evidence going the other way, and there is a lot of kind of murky. And that's the way a lot of trials proceed. The unusual thing here is that because of who this fellow is and how famous he is, it's very unusual to have someone of this stature with a case that is so thin.
Yeah, right. The biggest announcement in the world followed by the thinnest prosecution you could imagine. That's what it seems like.
Yeah, what it points up is the difficulty of pursuing the war on terror and an emphasis on gathering intelligence on one hand, and on the other hand, wanting to use the criminal justice system to prosecute some of these individuals, because those two goals don't always work together. And so if they had, from the beginning, if they had taken him into custody and given him a lawyer from the start, and then after giving him Miranda warnings and access to a lawyer, and then questioned him, and then obtained statements from him, they could use those statements in court, and it would be a much stronger case. But because they went a different way, and I have to say, the government thought that there was an ongoing plot, and so these things weren't done just to do them. The government took this intelligence gathering approach because they thought the country was in peril. They wanted to save thousands of lives. Frequently we look at these things as kind of a black and white, good guy, bad guy thing, but the government officials who were working on this case were doing what they were doing out of a sense that we were in peril as a country.
Yeah, but Paul Wolfowitz, who was the Deputy Secretary of Defense at the time, said that didn't look to him like there was any plot beyond some, quote, fairly loose talk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, I mean, that's the guy who was basically in charge of holding this guy.
There was. And, you know, from the beginning, there were people who were saying this. This isn't what it appears. This isn't what it appears. But, you know, after the fact, you can sort of see it and put it into perspective. But as it's going on, if it's your responsibility, and I don't mean to defend, I'm just trying to describe.
No, you're a reporter. You're doing a great job.
Yeah, yeah.
And I really appreciate your perspective here and,
okay.
And making sure that you know, we stay on point here and don't just get after, you know, condemning John Ashcroft or whatever, but get to the truth here. I want the truth.
Okay. Cause what's going on here is, you know, if it's my responsibility, I want to make sure that I'm not the guy who said, oh, we don't have to worry about this fellow, and then suddenly, boom, there's a mushroom cloud somewhere. And I mean, I don't want to give you the wrong idea. These guys were never talking about using nuclear weapons. They were talking about having an explosive device that would spread, you know, radioactive material.
Right.
And it's much, much different. It's just not even in the same league. It's much more. Anyway, you get the idea.
Here's
the
another,
point is, you don't want to be the one. You don't want to be the one, and particularly after 9/11, you don't want to be the one who's going to let somebody do something. And so a lot of officials are acting in an abundance of caution. Now, where the debate begins is, okay, under those circumstances, then what do you do? How do you proceed?
Oh, well, I go with the Bill of Rights.
Is it appropriate? Yeah, exactly. Is it appropriate to sort of push aside those protections that have applied traditionally and go a different way, or should we? Anyway, that's where the debate is.
Sure. Let me ask you this. I've gathered this impression from scant information, really, is why I need you to help me understand. It seems to me that the only reason these other two guys were indicted was so they could tack Padilla's indictment onto theirs and make believe that they had a real trial here. I'm reading in your most recent article that these two others had been under surveillance since 1993, and you know that the state had recorded hundreds of thousands of phone calls. Apparently, they didn't seem to think that these two were very dangerous for some extended period of time before finally indicting them. Were they just trying to cover and say, no, really, this is a real terrorism case, we promise, see, and so that they could try to make, you know, bolster the case against Padilla?
Well, no, I think it went the other way around. I think it was the other way. These two guys, Adham Hassoun and K. Kifa Jayusi. They're the co-defendants on trial with Padilla. There are some other co-defendants as well, but they're not in the country. They're fugitives. But these two guys were in government custody, and they had been under surveillance, it's true, since late 1993, because the government suspected they were connected to terrorists. And again, this is another example of the difficult intersection between intelligence gathering and law enforcement, because the operation against Hassoun and Jayusi was an intelligence gathering operation. They wanted to listen so that they could hear and be prepared if there was a bomb plot that was coming up or something else.
So it was under a FISA warrant, not a regular warrant, not a regular criminal division warrant.
Right? That's right. These were FISA intercepts. And as near as I can tell, they were, well, I mean, I can't tell. As the court has ruled that these FISA intercepts were legal. What I'm not clear about is what happened to the intercepts later during the Bush administration, when we know that there were some other procedures that were undertaken. I'm not sure that this case falls under those. You know what I'm talking about?
Right, right. And just to let you know here, we're just under 2 minutes left.
Okay. But at any rate, what happened is that these guys were under surveillance, and the government was considering, after the 9/11 attacks, the government then took Hassoun into custody and was considering what to do with him, whether to deport him or whether to charge him. And eventually the government got around to charging him. Now, when that situation we talked about earlier with the Supreme Court and Padilla came up, the government looked at its options. And one of its options was to, in a sense, to put him into the case with Hassoun, and that's what they did. And so they moved him out of the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court and put him into that Miami case because there was some overlap between Hassoun and Padilla.
Mm-hmm.
But to put it into perspective, of the 300,000 recorded phone conversations, I think 79 of the conversations that are contained in the government's case today came from Hassoun. 7 of those conversations involve a recording of Padilla's voice. That's out of 300,000 intercepted conversations.
Mm-hmm. And you say in your article that 285,000 of these are being kept from the defense where they might find Brady material.
Yes, those conversations have not been summarized, and so because they've not been summarized, they're effectively out of the reach of the defense.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I hope that you continue to cover this case and that we can bring you back to explain further developments over the months that it's apparently going to take to hold this trial.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I plan to be keeping an eye on the case, yeah.
Great. All right. Thanks very much for your time today, everybody. Warren Ritchie from the Christian Science Monitor.
I told her, see you later.